Hello everyone, I'm Lee. I'm never introduced to speaker at this meeting, but this speaker that I'm introducing tonight, I've introduced him at least 2 weeks ago at another meeting. So I guess he and I are going to be a team here from now on. A lot of you know him. He's you know him by his name followed by particular consonants. Not a C, not a CK, but with a K. He's my good friend. I'll just say this: Eric is perhaps one of the most generous people that I've met in Al-Anon. He's been one of my best friends in Al-Anon. It's really hard for me to imagine how somebody who grew up in like a family of like 16 could be so generous, but Eric is that person. When I about a year into Al-Anon, I went to my first retreat. That if you're not familiar with this meeting, this meeting does two retreats twice a year. And one of these years I went with Eric, and I did not know Eric at all. He was a complete stranger to me, and we rode together in a car. And we didn't really know what to talk about, but we started talking about music. And at some point, we both realized that we both loved the band Soundgarden. And as soon as we realized that, and he said that he had that in his car, we just spent the next 2 hours going to the desert singing our butts off to Soundgarden. And on our way back, Eric and I actually made a trip to find some random monument out in the desert that involves some other band. And so, after that, Eric, it's safe to say that Eric and I were just buddies after that. And it's been a real pleasure to grow alongside him. So here I'll introduce Eric with a K. Thanks, guys.
Hey everybody, my name is Eric Forsberg, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I have been given a lot of nicknames in Al-Anon. AA does this too. You got some guy I remember meeting at one of these conferences I went to, and his name was Joe, but it was Asked Me a Question Joe, because he used to go around axing people's doors. But anyway, we have fun nicknames that we get in program, and I've been called Eric with K. I've been called Eric with an AK, meaning like an AK-47. Where I got that one, but I like it. I've been called, when I busted my Achilles and had to go in and get surgery, they called me Eric with a cane, and which I didn't like at all. And you're not supposed to like your nicknames, by the way. If you're making up your own nicknames, you belong in Al-Anon, okay? Anyway, so when I didn't need the cane anymore and I quickly got rid of it, they just called me Eric without a cane. I hated that too. So, but when I was growing up as a kid, my family gave me a nickname as well. And I like to play with these like wicker wine bottles that were in our house. My mother used those to, put candles in and whatnot. And there I am at that age learning how to walk. And I'm playing with these things like they're my toys. But I'm walking down a hallway and I'm not walking very well. And my sister looks at me. She sees this person waddling down what looks like a hallway, like a drunk. And she says, "What? It's Boozer." And so my family have called me Booze ever since. Now, if that's not the most alcoholic nickname you've ever heard, I don't know. Yeah. But it's like that just my family is fantastic. I mean, and totally insane at the same time. And we had a lot of fun, but it was crazy growing up at my home. So basically, I'm the adult grandchild of an alcoholic that married the daughter of an alcoholic. And if you want to hear my short story, that's it right there. And both those things basically brought me into my knees and brought me into an Al-Anon. But growing up, I didn't realize that alcoholism had any influence on our household. I didn't know that my dad's dad was an alcoholic. I didn't know that. Why? Well, my dad never introduced me to that man. He figured he did a massive geographic and moved a good 3,000-4,000 miles away that we'd be safe from the disease of alcoholism. Didn't work. I'm going to tell you, it didn't work at all. Instead, my dad became that person in our neighborhood who everyone thought was the token alcoholic of the neighborhood, even though he never touched a drop of alcohol in his life. He was the person who was super angry all the time. He was the around person. He basically carried the disease, the family disease of alcoholism. And his life wasn't crazy and chaotic enough. So he married my mom, and I would come to learn that my mother had schizophrenia. And I guess my dad was a fixer-upper as well, just like me. And so growing up in a home like that, where, like, here, I'm going to bend your head a little bit. Just go with me on this. So my mother never wanted to have any children, but she had 14 of them. Why? Why would a woman do that? Well, she was schizophrenic. And when asked, and she explained it later when she was on her medication and she could think more straight, she says, "Well, most people when they get pregnant, it throws them off. Like it doesn't, it's not good. Like their hormones kind of go all over the place, and it can be a bad thing." For her, with her state of mind, being schizophrenic, being pregnant actually balanced her out. So having children was like her drug of choice. And she wasn't well enough to be able to actually raise us, but she was well, she wanted to basically have that experience, balance herself out for about 9 months, and then, give birth. And then, well, I think I was raised by a lot of my older siblings, and my mother would just, I remember the math of it was, I think I remember like wondering, geez, how long does it, how much time is it when you put all the pregnancies back to back? How long was she pregnant for? It's over 11 years being pregnant. And when that stopped working for her, she divorced my dad and she left. So, like, there was so much chaos in my home growing up. And the what made it really, really crazy was the alcoholism that had come through my dad's side of the family was could hide in plain sight because this other illness took front and center stage. And the thing about alcoholism, it's probably the most insane disease that there is. Like, I don't know that there's a worse disease that you can have. Because I've seen people with schizophrenia get on medication and they're okay. But I've never seen anybody who was alcoholic get on medication and be okay. I've never seen any Al-Anonics just get on a little bit of medication and be all right. That's my story. I needed a huge, a lot more help than just a little bit of medication and stuff. And so, when I was little, my like the sickness in the family was developing. It wasn't all bad at first. I remember growing up really admiring my mom for like I think I was grade kindergarten, and she made a Captain Marvel suit for me. I think she gave me my sister's underwear that she painted silver. And but that was fine because she painted the, rubber boots that I had silver as well. So that all worked together with nylons and stuff. And I think I took it to school on, the day where you what do you call it? Like where you show something off that's from your house or whatever. Show and tell, that's what it is. I did it for show and tell 2 days in a row. So I love my mom. Like I thought it was so cool. And my mom was a really interesting person. She's a great painter, for a huge artist. My dad's like a landscape architect who designs national parks and things like that. He had a really cool job. He did a lot of really cool things in his life too. But when you stepped into our house, the house that I never wanted any friends to ever have to come into, but for the shame of just what they might see if they came in. On the outside, we looked awesome, but on the inside, we were dying inside. And so one of the ways I tried with my family to kind of get by was to look good on the outside, even though the inside was just decaying away. That's, some days worse than others. And I remember like my parents being really enamored with each other. That's a fancy way of saying completely obsessed. And that meant that there wasn't much parenting going on. And frankly, my dad grew up in an alcoholic home where We're yelling and screaming at each other as a sign of love. There's no real loving skills there that he could bring in. He didn't have the tools himself, and so he did the best he could. And my mom, being sick the way she was, did the best she could as well. And what that meant was I was completely free to be, you know, picked on, beat on, attacked by any of my older siblings because they were not doing too good in the situation. And, you know, poop rolls downhill there. That's the nice way to say it. And so I was the eighth kid. I'm the oldest of this. What is it? The youngest half. And I was the first one born in Canada. So you might hear a little bit of that weird Canadian A there in there, eh? So, yeah, don't worry about that. That's just me and my Fargo love affair. And the things that happened at home, we tried to be like this perfect family on the outside. And in fact, a newspaper came. They're called the Clarion. Probably look this up if you really wanted to. But it was like, but this family of Forsbergs, they have 14 kids and they're all like dressed like they look like they're coming out of military school or something. And they're all getting like straight A's. This is an amazing family. How does they do it? And they'd come in and they'd interview my mom and they'd say, how is it that you, just one person, could be a mother to all these 14? Like, isn't that exhausting? And her arrogance, I would love her. I love her arrogance. It's so funny. She says, what kind of a woman are you if you can't? And they'd be like, oh, no, I just put the foot in my mouth. And then they would say things like, well, you know, but who helps them with the homework? Well, and she'd talk about all these plans and things that, you know, you got tutors coming in. That's just older brothers and sisters helping the younger ones. And like cooks that were cooking. Well, that's just my younger sister helping my mom out. Like we were all basically working a concentration camp style kind of thing and making it look like it was Partridge Family. Like it was insane. And so at some point, you know, I had the tendency of being, I was that kid that was like, okay, well, I see the need for help. I'm only five. Let me do the dishes. Now, anybody here ever worked at a restaurant doing dishes? Yeah, that's playground work compared to the dishes at our house. If you come in the morning, they'd have breakfast, and they'd use up most of the dishes. And then by lunch, they'd use up the rest. And then so you had to wash them as soon as I got home from school. And then they would do dinner, and dinner every night was like Thanksgiving. So they'd go through everything, and nobody cooked in the pots properly. Everything got crusted with a thing like this thing. And it was insane. So like it would take me until about 11 o'clock every night to finish the dishes. I remember I'm 5 years old doing this and thinking, I finally feel like I matter in this house, like I'm somebody. If you've ever worked that hard to try and keep your life together with an alcoholic, I just want to say welcome to Al-Anon. You're in the right place. And the day came when I got to voice my concern about how often I had to do the dishes. And my parents essentially just said, so what? We don't care. And something inside of me that day broke. I think I was about six. So I'd done it for about a year. It almost exhausted me. One of my great resentments as a kid was sitting in that kitchen and washing all those dishes and cleaning out the floor, which was like insane. And all the time I'm listening to my family members across that wall where the living room was, watching and laughing at the Looney Tunes or different shows that I wish I could have been watching. But I was too busy being a slaving away. And it was like, you know, so I figured, well, I'm getting broken by this experience. It's too much, but I volunteered for it. That's the weird thing. I could have just said, I'm not doing it anymore. There were plenty of my family members who just said, no, I'm not doing it anymore. And my parents didn't do anything. I thought they were going to kill me if I said I was going to stop, but I saw that I could stop, but I just couldn't. I couldn't stop. So I had a compulsion even as a kid to try and please other people. And so this disease really reached inside of me. And for multiple generations, like sliding downhill, it's affecting me like at the age of five and six. It's giving me the sense that If I'm to get anything I need in this world, it's gonna be up to me to get it. Nobody else is gonna help me with nothing. I got to do it myself. And that's gonna shape that actual core belief system shaped how I did every relationship after the age of six. I remember in recovery, I'm in recovery about 10 years, and I'm thinking, I had the best friend in the neighborhood that I used to actually bring over. And we'd play outside my place. And well, one time our dog chewed his hand and he didn't come any back anymore. But it was like, that's a dog. That's an Al-Anonic dog, by the way. If it's, oh, it's a new person. It just chew a hand. That's a dog ready to protect itself. So, and I had this guy. He was an amazing friend to me. And then all of a sudden he just disappears for like, I don't know, 10 years or something. So I'm on Facebook and I'm like, hey, Joe, you remember me? It's Eric. Oh, we were like best friends, man. Like we hung out all the time. Where'd you go? And his answer was amazing to me. He said, I didn't go anywhere. I was in every one of your classes. I thought he left me. What had actually happened is I crawled so far inside of myself, I was so afraid of everyone and everything that even my best friends were not worth connecting with anymore. And I blame them for it. Classic Al-Anonic, like move on my part. And so it was like, growing up, my self-esteem was pretty little. I took it kind of personal that I couldn't overcome and beat this disease that only no human power can beat. I did everything I could to try and make our family look good. So I got really good grades in school, and I didn't really do much for my self-esteem. I went out and I got trophies in sports. Like I got all this stuff to go out and try and be somebody, to feel like I am somebody. And all it did was sort of like, wow, I fooled them. That's kind of how I felt. Well, I guess I fooled them again. And so when I started dating in high school and stuff, girls are coming in and they're like showing some interest in me. Back then I had more hair than I have now. It's just, I used to have a mane. It was pretty nice. And the Steven Seagal that was in back then, and I could support that like nobody's business. And I thought I was pretty cool. I was into music and all this stuff. And my self-esteem, the way I felt, just from everything that had happened when I was growing up, it just I figured I just was lucky if a girl even knew my name. And so those were the qualifications for dating for me. Oh, you know my name? You think I'm kind of cute? It's Vaughn. Anybody relate to that? I hope you don't. But it's like, okay, so I dated for 2 weeks, they drop me. I date somebody else for 2 weeks, they drop me. I just figured, okay, my mom divorced my dad. She dropped out of the family too. Every woman in my life that I'm ever going to be with is going to drop me at some point. I believe that. And all of a sudden, all my friends in high school are like pill popping, drug addicted kinds of people that go out on the weekends. And for me, I thought that was fun to go and hang out with them because they could kick it loose and they could stop freaking out all the time or worrying because I used to have this terrible, terrible sense of worry. And those were my friends. Those are the people that I felt like comfortable with. The alcoholism my dad went through didn't skip a generation. It slid right into home plate in my family. And I began like, without knowing that why I'd be so comfortable around addicts and alcoholics. Like, why? Because that's what my dad is like. Even though he's an outlaw. And anyway, I get through high school, and Matt, I just get through it. It's like the worst. I hate high school. There was nothing cool about it, really. It's just good to be done with it. And then my life felt like it started because I could get a job and make a little bit of money and start calling some of my own shots. And moved in with one of my girlfriends, and that was fine for, I don't know, a little while. And then I met her. And if you're an Al-Anon like me, you say her, the one, one that's going to just make everything better. I meet her and I'm like, oh, this talking's not so bad. I could do a little bit of this if it means I can get closer. And I didn't think of it like that when I was at age. I just didn't know any better. And so I remember like connecting, finally connecting and going on a date and stuff. And I didn't pay any attention to the fact that she was wearing an engagement ring somebody else had given her. That was no big deal. I was like, oh, that's a nice little ring there. So on one of your funny fingers, what's the, and I just ignored it. So any red flags, I just painted them green, because I want this to work. And before you know it, 2 weeks in, instead of her dumping me, she says, I want to marry you. That's not a red flag. It's a challenge. Okay. If you're like me, that's just a challenge. I'd never even rented my own apartment before. I was totally a child. Outwardly, I was 21 or 22, but inside, I was maybe 10, maybe 11. Like just an idiot. And this girl wanted an idiot. And I was like, fine, I'll do whatever it takes to get this to work. So I moved to a different city. And I did things I never thought I would ever do to be with somebody that I thought this was it. This was it. But she's the daughter of the alcoholic that I met that was just, well, it's like magic. It's incredible, the feeling. Like we related so easily. We sit in bed at night after we got married. It only took 5 months and we were married. We jumped right into it and took ourselves hostage. And we both had what you think are sex problems. That was just you just want more than you get. And for me, it was like, now I'm gonna get all the sex I ever wanted. And she was like, yeah, I need to get all the sex I ever wanted too. So I'll tell you what, let's make a pact. Anytime you want sex, you just come to me and we'll just make it happen. And I was like sitting there thinking, this is perfect, man. This is awesome. And until, of course, the pact breaks down. Like it was really fun at first. We had a lot of fun. Then there was fun with fights, and then enough time came by where all there was fights. It was just fights. Al-Anons, I think their drug of choice is control. Yeah, especially over other people. And we were two Al-Anons. I grew up with a dad who I was a adult grandchild, and she was an adult child. Her dad was alcoholic. I met him as a fantastic man in AA, a 25-year sobriety when I married his daughter. And so she, during the beginning of our marriage, she's mentioning Al-Anon a little bit. And I'm like, going, yeah, whatever. I'm going through university and I'm studying things in psychology. And I think I know better than Al-Anon's tools and all that kind of stuff. So I just shut that off and think it's a kind of a silly thing. And she's like, yeah, I think I probably should go. And I'm like, well, go ahead and go. I'm not going. I'm too busy with, band stuff and school and everything else. And I didn't think I needed any kind of help. I figured we were good, man. We were solid. The two of ourselves made each other whole. That's how I felt. I remember sitting in one of our men's stag meetings here for 7 o'clock, let's rock. And the guy got up and he goes, if two half people get together, they don't make themselves whole. They eat themselves alive until there's nothing left. And I was like, oh, I wish I knew that when I got married, because it was essentially what ended up happening between us, that there wasn't enough health even between the two of us to for us to be healthy like when the other one wasn't. Like it was bad. And eventually she says to me, she goes, hey, look, you're the problem in this marriage. You're the reason everything's chaotic and insane. You're making me crazy, so you need to go and get help somewhere. And at the time, I was seeing a therapist I didn't want to see, but I was seeing a therapist. And I went to the therapist and says, where would you recommend a guy like me go? Because I don't know what to do. I want this marriage to work, but I can't see it. Nothing I do seems to be good enough. And I'm not appreciated in the marriage like I want to be. And valued. And she looked at me and she says, well, you should probably go to Al-Anon. And I was like, Al-Anon, what's Al-Anon? What's that? She goes, well, have you heard of AA? I'm like, well, yeah, that's where the drunks go, right? And she goes, well, yeah, that's where they go to recover, but the rest of the family go to Al-Anon to get better. And I was like, the rest of the family have to do that? She goes, well, they don't have to do anything, but it helps. And so I went for a little bit, and then I came back to therapists, and I was deeply impressed by you people in Al-Anon. You said things like keep coming back, and I was like, yeah, there is a welcome in that. That feels really nice to a guy like me that was really alone and hurting. Somebody wanted me to come back. That was a good feeling. I like that. I need it turned out I needed that. I didn't know I needed that, but I was starving for it. You guys were giving me love and attention. You'd let me talk for 3 minutes without interrupting. It was amazing. I could say the craziest stuff too, and everything that. I remember being at one of the off-sites, and I lost it. I lost my cool. I couldn't hold it in anymore. And I told all the men how much I hated their guts, because I grew up with a dad that was really violent. I didn't trust any man. And here I was feeling like, well, I let somebody drive me up there. What was I thinking? I didn't have a way to leave. So there I am, stuck, feeling like trapped. And I told those guys, I can't trust you. And here's why. And I told them one of the incidents that happened between my dad and I, a night where I thought I might die. It got that bad. And when I sat down, 52 men jumped up out of their seats, clapping their hands louder than I've ever heard them clap. I'd always wanted to share good so somebody would pat me on the back because I wanted that attention. I didn't know that's how you ordered an Al-Anon is to tell them off. And the reason they were clapping and so excited for me is for the first time in Al-Anon, I told the truth. I was getting honest. This, you know, I played a lot of games with myself in reality before that point. I didn't think I could tell people the truth about what was going on because I thought they would just reject me. I was so afraid of that. And I'm feeling this awesomeness coming from Al-Anon. I even, like, I don't know what I was thinking, but I got myself a sponsor and I started doing some step work and I started to see progress, things changing that I never thought would change. And I go back to my therapist and I'm like, oh, I hate you. She goes, why? What's wrong? Al-Anons are awesome. She goes, and you hate me for that? She goes, and I'm like, yeah. Why? Because I have to leave them. She's like, why do you think you have to leave them? I says, well, because they keep saying if somebody's drinking a sobriety by the shoe, welcome to Al-Anon. And I was like, I don't relate to that at all. Remember, my dad's not a drinker. His behavior was driving me nuts. You know, my wife was not a drinker either. Her behavior was driving me nuts. I was kind of an Al-Anon because of other Al-Anons, not alcoholics. And she goes, you dummy. You're in Al-Anon because of the family disease of alcoholism. And it travels through the generations. The alcoholics, you don't even see them because they're gone. But the disease is still right there in your face. And I was like, I don't get it. I don't get it. She says, well, you have a sponsor. Call him and ask him if he ever wondered if he belonged to Al-Anon. Now I thought, okay, this is going to be a slam dunk. I'm out. I'm out because I'm going to call my sponsor whose wife is the alcoholic. And boy, heard from the stories I heard him tell, man, she drank a lot. But she made chaos of that house. It seemed pretty obvious to me that when I asked him, okay, did you ever have a problem, you know, wondering if you belong now and on with your situation? That he would say, well, what are you kidding me, man? My wife drank so much. Yeah, of course I knew I was belonging to Al-Anon right from the beginning. But I call him and he goes, no, I wasn't sure I belonged to Al-Anon either, too. But I go, how long did it take for you to figure that out? He goes, 3.5 years. I went, oh my, I've only been in about a year. Like, how? I'm asking the question in a year. You're saying it took you 3 years to figure out that you belong. And he goes, yeah. And I says, why 3 years? That's a long time. He goes, because she hid her drinking. Ain't that how alcoholism, the family disease, is? It hides really well. It can hide in plain sight. And that's what gave me the gift of knowing I belonged in Al-Anon, because I realized, oh, I'm just another Al-Anon having a hard time seeing where the disease is coming from. And that's a common trait amongst most Al-Anons. They have a hard time coming in and wondering if they belong. So if you're here confused, you're not sure if you belong in Al-Anon, I'll tell you what my I came back and I told my therapist what the answer was, and she goes, see, the fact that you think you don't belong in Al-Anon means you belong in Al-Anon. And I was like, you're a trickster, man. Nice job. I'm not buying it, right? And she's like, no, that's the truth. And it happens to the ones that are the clear cases, in the like in my case, the less than clear cases. So if you feel like you're one of those less than clear cases. From my heart to yours, grab a hold of this program that we have and work it as hard as you can, because you're probably in an even worse case of the disease of alcoholism, because over any period of time, it gradually gets worse, not better. You're worse off if it was your grandfather and not somebody like your dad. You're worse because it's had time to just progress. And then it hits you and slams into you like a huge hurricane. And you're sitting there wondering, why is the pain and the chaos so insane and insidiously huge? The answer is because it's got that gravity over multiple generations, and it's just hitting you. And you might be the first one in your family to have that awareness. I loved what the person that had 1 year said. Very honest. Who here enjoys doing step work? Yeah, I didn't see any hands go up. I saw one, and he's just one of 20 or something. None of us enjoy the process of recovery. It's like, oh, let's go into the hospital and let's have full-on surgery. Yeah, that sounds like fun. It's one of those things where it's like when the light turns on, starts to turn on. Where you know you can't change yourself, but you can at least see what the disease is doing to you. To me, that is the perfect step one in Al-Anon. It's realizing just how powerless you are over stopping this disease from destroying your life. A person that gets to that realization is in a really good place in Al-Anon, because now they have a motive to find themselves a higher power that will overcome the impossible. And for me, I came in and it took, oh boy, it took me 8 years to get to that place that you got to in 1 year. So fuck, that's amazing. I came into program and I decided I was going to work out on my way. And it turned out the only things in this program that worked for me were not my ideas. They had to come from somewhere, and someone else. And I sat down. I remember, I was getting better in Al-Anon, and finally stuck with it. And that's when my wife decided to go her own way. And to this day, I admire her and her courage. She's a fabulous person who's had to suffer like I have with the disease, and found out not too long ago that she's been in Al-Anon now for a good while, and she's finding some freedom from this disease as well. So, and today I realize, like, even if it had been therapy or some other method that we had gone through to figure out what was going on in our marriage and why it wasn't working, we would have had to separate at some point because we weren't a match. I'd never done an inventory of myself. How am I supposed to know what my relationship needs are? I have no clue. Until I've come in Al-Anon and I found a higher power that doesn't judge me at all. My higher power's got my picture on the fridge. My higher power plays guitar with a wah-wah pedal. And this invented like universities and studios to make like educational stuff just to make me happy because I love learning. My higher power is essentially a gentle giant. The kind that's really powerful but would never, ever hurt me. And it was, I didn't know God like that. My sponsor at the time sat me down and says, "Let's just make a list of people in the Al-Anon era that you admire or love. And then write the reasons why you admire or love them." And then he says, "Okay, now we're going to practice principles above personality and we're going to remove the names. Just the qualities." Says, that's the qualities your higher power has. That's what you can turn your will and your life over to." So once I was, I was introduced to the fact that I had been trying to control something that I couldn't control, and that's a family disease. And it was hard letting go of that illusion that I could somehow make people think, feel, or do what I want. But I started to get better when I learned, okay, well, I can't make people think, feel, or do what I want. And if I try to act like that, things will go bad. And if I act as if I can't control them, things go much better. I was very much like an alcoholic. Their great obsession is to someday control and enjoy their drinking like other people. And in Al-Anon, Al-Anon, like me, my great obsession was to someday control and enjoy people like other people. The reality is, if you're trying to control them, you don't really enjoy them. But if you want to enjoy them, don't control them. Such a simple thing. And they introduced me to that. So they introduced me to that reality, and then they introduced me to the reality of my higher power. And then they said, "Okay, now let's take a good and close look at you." And I ran away for 3 years. And I was like, no, that's too scary. I think if you look, if I sit down and I have to do this inventory, I'm afraid that like the sponsor that I trust is gonna end up seeing me the same way I see myself, and I don't have a very high opinion of myself, and so I don't want that to happen. So I go off and I do grief therapy for 3 years, which left me feeling super suicidal and crazy. So all of a sudden, I was willing to come back and do that inventory because that didn't sound as bad. So, wire it's a funny way of letting me do my own thing sometimes because it gets me ready for the next thing. And so I did that and I came in and I did my fourth step. And when I was done, I was like, wow, I've only got five character defects. So does everybody else. It's the same. So I'm not the biggest piece of crap, not even close. And my shortcomings were just areas in my life I hadn't developed. So where I was impatient or where I was had low self-esteem or where I, lacked enough compassion, or I could just be mean, Those are all shortcomings. I just had to, those were the things I had to make amends to myself for and grow up. And now on, you can grow up again. If you grew up like I did, and you just, no tools for a living by the people who were trying to raise you, well, it's no big deal. Turns out you can grow up again. You can have a lot of fun doing it. David's a great example of that. He and I are going up to this offsite. We go together and we, on the way back, we decide to open up a little bit, let each other in. And we discover we love the same band. Like, not just same band, the same album. It's our favorite album. We were just like, what? This is too cool. And so we're coming down off the, Joshua Tree. Like playing grounds there down in, and he goes, "Well, I know this band named Gaius, man. They're the best." And I'm like, "Oh, I think their signage thing from one of their albums is just past the street my sister used to live on. You want to go?" He's like, "Yeah, let's do it, man." And recovery can look that spontaneous and fun. We just come off the hill talking about all this heavy stuff, like I've been laying it down, and we go off and we have a blast. I think Al-Anon's like me, the depressed kind. Half to half a lot of fun in recovery, or they won't make it. Kind of has to balance out those lows. And I found that fellowship in the program is a huge and easy way to do that. So I find myself going to meetings where there's fellowship after the meeting too, where you just go hang out with people and just kind of talk. You know, open it up, shut it off, you know, do some, have some fun. Let some steam off. And for me, that's been really amazing part of the program and stuff. Our group has a little bit of a shindig get together just down the street at, where is it, the Habit? We try to make a habit of it. And that's a grandpa joke for those of you who didn't know. Because daddy jokes aren't dumb enough in my book. Anyway, we go down to the Habit and we just sit and have a milkshake or something, and we talk, we laugh, and we have a good time. And I know guys that live real far from this meeting, and they'll come and just hang with us because how much fun we have. And you're all welcome to come tonight. I'll be there. I grew up kind of like hating my dad because of just how sick he was. I thought for sure that there wasn't ever going to be any kind of harmony between my dad and me. And glad I was wrong about that. In recovery, it turns out that if you're wrong about something, that might be something to rejoice in. Because our old ideas and old ways are really what are killing us. And my old idea was that my dad's just too far gone. He's too sick. There came to be a point in time where his mind couldn't hold on to memories anymore. He would look at me and he'd look right through because he didn't know who I was. And at first that aggravated that feeling of, you know, I don't have that connection to my dad. And it hurt. And my sponsor says, okay, yeah, but what are you doing to connect? So I remember about a year and a half ago, I went to visit my family in Canada. Everything's cooly. And I hadn't planned on doing an amends. In fact, I was pretty sure I wasn't sure how you even do an amends. It's like, whose mind's far gone? They can't remember who you are. And I'm sitting in the back of my one of my older brother's house, and the family reunion is all there. I got all these brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews, and there's a lot of excitement. One of my great resentments in recovery is that my family is doing pretty good without Al-Anon. I have to go in and work it to the tooth, but some of them don't, and I'm actually grateful for that. But it did bother me at first, like, wow, you just let stuff go. How are you doing that? You know, like, I had to write for 3 years, you know, to get to that point. But in any event, I'm sitting there and my dad is in the corner and no one is talking to him, completely ignored. And one of the things that I had done through my life, the reason I needed to make an amends to my father, as bad as his behavior was that I nonetheless had just not been a very good son. You know, I didn't stay in regular contact. I didn't make much effort. I pushed him away and I ignored him and tried to pretend like he didn't exist. That's the worst thing you can do in a relationship. It's the most painful thing. Anybody who's ever ignored me, that hurts worse than if somebody tried to abuse me. And so I'm sitting there and The thought runs through my mind. I can hear you guys kind of rattle away in my head, and it said, "Go over there and say hi to your dad, dummy." And so I just went over and I grabbed a chair and I sat down with this person who doesn't even know who I am. And I says, "Hi, Lynn. Do you know who I am?" "No," he says, "I don't." I says, "I'm your son, Eric. I'm the child that you had, the very first child that you had in Canada when you moved here." He was like, "When was that?" And so we start going through this. Like, I start realizing that all that inventory work that I had done on my family, I realized my dad's cool. Like, he's a neat guy. Like, and so I sat there and I went through, well, here I am, my age, I'm living in the US. We're the same age that you decided to move to Canada. We have that in common. And he goes, "I didn't know her." And he says, "Yeah, and I got to see your sister before she passed." And he was like, "Oh, thank you for doing that." And then we got going through his career and we worked through his life. I just reminded him of his life, his exciting life that he's had. Because he's forgotten all that. And that, I was sure the conversation wouldn't last 5 minutes. Well, we're about 35 minutes in. And everyone from the family is now around us, listening to the family legacy that my father gave them. But he's not able to speak the words, but I am. And I finish, sharing about my dad's life and everything that he's accomplished and what he's been able to do. And I'm looking at the faces of my family members. All of them feel like I'm looking at their face and it's like they're looking at gold. And I sat there and I was like, I talked shit about my dad for decades. I put him down every chance I got. And I didn't realize that that day was the day that I would give back some dignity to my father in his life, not just to him, but to every single one of his sons and daughters. And we're sitting there listening, and the grandchildren too. And it was like, "Man, HP, you're good at what you do." Because I couldn't have tried to do that myself. I couldn't have planned it out better. And it wasn't my intent to do that. It naturally flowed and went there. And so I tell you guys, like, if you're like me and you came in and you look at that fourth and fifth step and it's like, "Oh, I can't do it. It's too much." I'm here to tell you, if you do it, you'll be underwhelmed. You'll be underwhelmed. You'll be like, "That's it?" We're like, "Yeah, that's it." And when you get to nine, if that scares the crap out of you too, it's a power step. All the steps are power tools. They work best if you plug it in with your higher power's use. And my events have all worked out that way. They've been really incredible. Like, if I had more time, I'd talk about the events I made in my mom. It's really similar. And even though both my parents have passed, the program's given me the ability to continue having a relationship with them anyway. And if you're wondering, well, how do you do that? Well, you pray for them. You don't have to stop doing things like that, even though they're not here anymore. Pray for their well-being, and you also be a good son or daughter. And that's how you honor those relationships, no matter what they've done. And in my case, my parents never came around and apologized to me for anything. And it doesn't matter. I'm free of that, free of the any guilt I felt about being a bad son. And I'm free to love them with all my heart. And today I do. They're very much guiding my life today. Half of who I am is my mom and my dad. I'll never get rid of them. And now today I'm grateful I don't ever have to. I don't ever want to. It's great to have parents. It's never too late to grow up again and have one. And I'll leave it with that. Thanks for letting me share.